The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Ken sat me down at his bar and said, right, lad, this is how you should approach your career. Live in the moment and think to yourself that now is the best time. And that has stayed with me for my whole career.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. Now, to my mind, F1's surge in popularity in the last 5 years is not because the sport has changed or improved. It's because it's like a sleeping giant that was always there, visceral, exciting. It lends itself so well to social media. And a lot of that is down to the fact that it's so visually rich. It's also a wonderful platform for storytelling. This week, we're going to explore this side of the sport with someone who works with both of these things. He deals in speed, spectacle, and personality. He's one of the great photographers of the modern era of Formula One. Darren Heath, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, James. Great to be with you.
When I first started working in the Formula One paddock in 1990, you were one of the first people that I met. It was the era of Senna, Prost, Mansell, Piquet, and then the following year, of course, Michael Schumacher. You had, a Canon camera and a long lens, and you were on a mission. What brought you there?
What brought me there? Well, a childhood passion for the sport that was engendered by my grandfather, by my father. It's a sport that has been, followed within my family for generations. And at about the age of 12, 13, I was given my first camera and going to Brands Hatch a lot with my father, following all the Grand Prix on TV. It just became my kind of passion in life. I realized, and I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, but I realized quite quickly that I could do this. I was very comfortable in the environment. I wasn't fazed by the speed, by the kind of the noise, by the sound, by the glamour of the drivers. And it became something that became my life's passion, that I wanted to photograph motorsport in general, but of course, Formula One being the pinnacle, that's where I aimed to get to.
You deal in spectacle and speed, like I said in the intro, but what you do is you freeze it. You capture it in a moment that otherwise would always be lost forever. But you've memorialized it in a frame for people around the world to enjoy. What goes through your mind when you're looking through the viewfinder and then you push the shutter?
It's a great question. And really, it's much like Michael Schumacher when he was asked, as you know, how do you do what you do? And his answer was, I just get in the car and I drive it. and really, that's not comparing myself to Michael Schumacher and his greatness, but I have that kind of sense with photography. Obviously, there's a tremendous amount of planning goes into the work that I want to do, and each race and each season kind of come with an attitude and an idea and constantly try to remain relevant as time goes on. But I guess the fundamentals for me are that I just want to get across to the to the viewer of my work, to the person that I'm fortunate enough to buy it or to work with or to hang my pictures on the wall, that I want them to get a sense of the passion that I feel for the sport that I adore. It's I've said it before, but it's an attack on the senses. It's all the cliches. It's the noise. It's the colour. It's the speed. It's the motion. As you say, it's an incredibly active sport where we deal in tremendously fast cars, the most wonderful prototype cars on the world every year. And it's my job to freeze those moments, but bring across the drama and the tension and the kind of the gladiatorial environment that we all work in.
You mentioned cliches. There is the old cliche that a photo or a picture is worth a thousand words. And I think that's been true of all the great F1 photographers over the 75 years of the sport. Bernard Caillé, his son Paul Henri particularly, Rainer Schlegelmilch, Bernard Asse. And it's true with you. How do you think about storytelling through images?
Well, thank you for comparing me to those legends of my craft. How do I compare? I guess, you know, I grew up looking at Rainer's work, particularly Bernard Asse's. He was a childhood hero of mine. Lewis Clement Askey, Jesse Alexander, all these guys that photographed the kind of dusty heroes of the past. And really, I'm a big believer in someone like me doesn't necessarily do anything different. You're just bringing your interpretation to what those photographers saw in the past, you know, and obviously we have tremendously complex cameras now that help photography in so many ways, but the basic fundamentals still remain. You're just trying to capture what you see in front of you and present it in as beautiful a way as possible, using light and speed and, you know, a little bit of kind of, or a lot really, of creative nous and trying to get across what you see in front of you.
And how do you think about the storytelling? I mean, you and I talk a lot at Grand Prix when we meet up, and there's always a narrative, right? There's always something going on in this sport. There's always subtexts and all those things. And we've been lucky enough to observe the characters and the personalities and also get to know them quite well. I mean, you spend time with them. In your case, you know, you've been on many sort of shoots and things where you actually have downtime with some of the iconic drivers in the last 30 years. So you've got a sense of their personality, you've got a sense of what's going on in their lives around them that must come when you're there pointing your camera either at their face when they're in the paddock or when they're driving through a, you know, at high speed through a fast chicane or something. Yeah. You're trying to tell a story. How do you sort of put narrative into an image?
It's a great point and something that I think the good photographers really do try and bring out, particularly as you say when you're out on track. You know, photographing Senna would be in my top 10, possibly top 5 moments of my career, or many moments photographing him, and he set the tone really. Qualifying hadn't started until Ayrton was on track.
You
hear that stab, 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 stab coming through the trees at Hockenheim, or coming through the forest at the Ardennes in Spa, you know, and you would hear that and you'd raise your game because he was on track. Latterly, it became more to me about a kind of personal sense and working around drivers, as you say, on shoots with them, but particularly on the grid. I've always been fascinated by the different characters of drivers and how they have that kind of comfort zone. Certain drivers would Nico Rosberg, Sebastian Vettel, they wouldn't mind if you were within inches of their face.
Because he basically wouldn't even know you were there because they're so concentrated.
Yes, exactly, because they just zone out and it didn't seem to matter. Carlos Sainz is fantastic like that now. Charles Leclerc, wonderful. You can be right in their faces and they don't mind. Obviously, you respect a certain area and I never photograph drivers eating, for instance, you know, those kind of things, but they're generally not doing that on the grid. But then you've got people like Michael Schumacher, who had a much further away sense of space. And of course, he was always, it seemed, very suspicious of what you were up to. Lewis Hamilton, he's not great to photograph close up. I've had some fantastic shoots with Lewis in private where he's great, and we've talked about photography, we've talked about Leica cameras and you know, just chewing the fat as you know you do with these guys. But then they kind of change when they get their race face on and get their head in the game. But as a photographer, you come to it, if you study that, and you can bring out certain things. You know, we're all aware of when you look back at Clement Askey's pictures or Reiner's pictures of guys with dirty faces and looking terrified as they're about to go out and drive around the Nordschleife. You know, and I try and have a sense of bringing that into my work.
You mentioned Reiner Schlegelmilch. I've been lucky enough to work with him quite a lot through my recent career. And, you know, if anybody is interested in this, have a look online and just look through some of Schlegelmilch's black and white photographs in the days when there was open face crash helmets for drivers, you know, Jim Clark and Bandini those people. Because, you know, they didn't cover their faces up. They didn't, you know, and sitting on the grid, I mean, there are some pictures of Reiner's from the 60s. And the drivers, as you say, they look absolutely terrified. And I remember, you know, talking to Jackie Stewart about this, and he always sort of said, you know, well, I used to win a lot of my races. He said, I won them on the grid, basically, by staying calm and in my own mind, and I wasn't panicking. And then I just got the job done in the first few laps. Everyone else is so nervous because they knew this could be the last few hours of their life.
Yeah.
And literally, you might not be coming back. And a lot of them sadly didn't come back.
Well, that's terror. Jackie is a hero of so many people. I think because he's still alive, and I think, you know, from so many of his contemporaries who died, obviously, at the time. And I think that backs up your point that he came to it with a kind of calmness and a sense of spirit in that way.
And Reiner was able to capture that fear.
Yeah.
But as you say, you're on the grid with them, and you have been, you know, since the beginning of the 90s, and some of the great drivers, and also some other drivers who perhaps had a little bit of imposter syndrome. They couldn't quite believe they were there. Some of them, frankly, who didn't deserve to be there.
Absolutely.
But have you, in modern times, do you ever see fear in the face of a modern Grand Prix driver, or what emotions would you say you do see in their faces if it's not fear?
I think the emotion that I most miss is joy, and is that exultant kind of happiness that they've won. I think that they're, as a photographer, one of my colleagues worked quite closely with Fernando Alonso when he was at Renault, and Fernando asked him about celebrating on a podium, celebrating when it in Parc Fermé when he gets out of the car. And the photographer rather wisely said, "Look, when you get out, do something. Be happy. Point towards where the TV cameras are or the photographers, and give.
Be demonstrative.
Be demonstrative. Be excited. Be exactly what we all feel would be like if we won a Grand Prix. And if it's your first, or your the wonderful thing about Michael Schumacher, he was the same in celebrating his first as he was in, was it 96?
91.
91, sorry. It was, yeah, whatever. Split hairs. It was the same when he won that final race that when he won the first race. Just whether you loved him or hated him, it was wonderful because he gave so much. Now we seem to live in an era, and I don't know whether it's because it's the time, but everyone seems to be wanting to be just too cool, and they don't celebrate so much. Interestingly, this year, especially in his awesome run of wins and coming back from over 100 points behind now to potentially winning a title, Max has kind of come out of himself and he celebrates more. And that's great because he was particularly poor at celebrating on the podium, always turning away from us, you know, and just, when I say us, I mean the media, even the crowd and the people watching around the world on the television. And that's, in answer to your question, that's what I miss. I don't really see fear. I think some of that has gone away because of the cocoon survival cell nature of these cars, and that fortunately we've gone quite a while now without having, you know, ostensibly a fatality at a racetrack, and long may that continue. So I think that there's an attitude of maybe over safety in some of the driving that we see, in some of the risks that they take now. But I'm not a jealous man, but maybe I'm envious of people like Reiner and Bernard and Clement Askey, that they could see the drivers, they could bring that sense of fear or loathing out of the drivers, you know, because you just don't see it now.
So if we look at what you're actually doing, I mean, you're a photographer, so photographers take pictures of everything. I'm sure if someone hired you for their wedding, you'd take the most unbelievable photos, even though you're not probably a wedding photographer.
I've done a few.
I'm sure you have. But, you know, there's two completely different skills. Capturing a racing car travelling at 180 miles an hour in front of you, a few hundred, maybe less than the few tens of metres away from you, no more.
Yeah.
Or even closer in Monaco. That's one skill. And then capturing faces, which is another thing that, that you do very well. Totally different skill set. We'll come back to talk about the racing cars in a minute, but what's the key to capturing faces and revealing the character behind the face?
For me, it's there was a great sports photographer called Amy McCabe many years ago that I studied and saw lectures with Eamon, and I didn't know him, but his great kind of moniker was or kind of principle was that don't shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. Really wait until they're right close, and that's really what I try and do. I love, as I think I said before, I love working the grid because you can get so close. What's changed so much in photography now is that of covering a Formula One is that we see the drivers so little. We used to see them a tremendous amount. You know that. Access now is really kind of, you know, difficult. And I understand pressures on time and social media has changed things and engineering meetings take longer and all these things. But really, it's my attitude is to get right in close, get as close as I dare, and really get all the kind of other details and other kind of elements that could take attention away from the subject in the picture away. So whether that's using a certain type of lens, whether that's, which generally would be quite a short lens, a 50 millimeter lens, so you have to come close. Using a quite a wide open depth of field, so you blur everything around. And really just trying to bring a sense of that character out of the driver.
And turning to action shots then, I mean, Rainer Schlegelmilch coined the term freezing speed to describe a technique that he brought in the sort of late 60s, early 70s, when kind of Kodachrome and colour film became a real thing. I think he was kind of basically pulling the zoom or pushing the zoom at the same time as, and it's zoom cameras, zoom lenses came in.
He was doing both.
And zoom lenses, of course, were a new thing as well. So he was playing with technology, such as it was at the time, to basically freeze speed. And so it would be pin sharp maybe on the driver's helmet, but then with a Ferrari or something, there'd be this blur of red.
An explosion
that just conveys speed in an image. It's something that obviously you and your peers can show, that mind-blowing speed in a still image. So, I mean, obviously technology has moved on, but how do you do that? What's the key to capturing speed in an image?
Using techniques that like Rainer did, of course, it became a kind of a real look that he perfected. And when someone else has perfected a look, I generally try and shy away from that because I'm of course, you know, you're always aware of what your peers are doing and what went before, but I'm trying to bring in techniques of my own. I'm a big proponent of photographers, young photographers particularly, when I give presentations or lectures, that kind of thing, to really don't just study what photographers in motorsport are doing. Of course, be aware, but really look at what great directors of photography in the movie industry are doing, what fashion photographers, architectural photographers, reportage guys who maybe are covering conflict zones, really try and bring in what they're doing. And maybe that's lens choice. Maybe that's, these days, so many people use presets in Photoshop editing. I don't have one preset. I'm a bit old school like that. But of course, everyone edits their work since the days of daguerreotypes and Man Ray. Every photographer has edited their work. You have to, if you're shooting editorially, remain true to what happened in front of you. But artistic license is something that all photographers really should embrace.
And which tracks, Darren, are your favourites to shoot at, and why? What is? I mean, I imagine the quality of the light. I mean, we're sitting here now in a lovely morning here in Abu Dhabi. As you can probably hear, the birds are singing around us. We're surrounded by palm trees, and it's all very pleasant. But the light is tremendous here.
It's lovely.
And of course, it's special here because the light fades, doesn't it?
It does.
You have a kind of twilight race. The floodlights come up, and you go into darkness. I think it's magical to be in the paddock, to be around. It creates a really wonderful, almost like a party-like atmosphere, really.
I said last night to someone, it's a party race, exactly that.
Yeah, but it's dead serious, of course, for the three drivers fighting for the championship. But yeah. So is this one of your favourites? And which ones are the really best ones to shoot Formula One cars at?
Well, it's a question that obviously one gets asked a fair bit about what's your favourite circuit to work at. And without wishing to sound kind of dismissive, for want of a better word, I kind of go to all of them as my favourites. That's the attitude I try and have. Obviously, one goes to places, you know, Melbourne has so much going for it as a racetrack. Monaco, I really enjoy Shanghai, the scale of it, the architectural dominance of the place. Lots of photographers can't stand it. Turkey was not popular with many photographers. I always went there thinking, right, it's probably Tilke's tour de force as a racetrack. Let's try and bring that out. If other photographers are dismissive, it drives me to think, right, on Monday morning, when you see my work, at Monday morning as was, when you see my work, you're going to think, hang on a minute, it's not such a bad circuit. I could have, you know, how did he do this or he do that? You know, or I will look at some of the other good photographers and get inspiration from them. But of course, there are some circuits, this being one of them, where you get wonderful light. We did, where this one of the areas where the sport has changed, we did back in the day always have a race at, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, which is the worst light you can possibly have. That changed, obviously, with the advent of, I think it was Singapore was the first night race, wasn't it? And that was like a wonderful, wonderful event to cover. And it's still possibly my favourite, just because there's something about that. The heat of the city, the skyscrapers, the colour, the noise, the proximity of the cars. As a spectator, go to Singapore because you can get very close. There are areas where you're almost as close as the photographers are. And the cars seem to take on a glossy hue there and move about on the circuit. And there's
sparks are more visible.
Sparks, everything. It gives so much visually, that race. And you know, then you've got races like this, where, as you say, you're just constantly dealing as a photographer with an evolving light, you know, that goes from, like now, because we're later in the year, it's still nice at midday, but then it goes into that golden, purpley, kind of inky black night. And under tremendous floodlights.
I agree with you, Darren, on Singapore, and I think a lot of people do, and certainly F1 does, because if you look at a lot of the sizzle reels for Formula One, generally they tend to be quite Singapore heavy.
They do,
in terms of making the cars, the spectacle of Formula One, really stand out.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Drinking and driving is a decision that will change your whole world. Things will never be the same once you get a DUI, because legal fees and time in court are just the beginning. Getting into a crash is another way your world could be irreversibly changed after drinking and driving. Your vehicle may not be the only thing that gets damaged in that crash. You could face a life-altering injury or even death. But you're not the only one who could face those consequences. Your decision to drink and drive could permanently change someone else's world, whether you injure them or leave their loved ones grieving. The next time you're out drinking, call a rideshare, a taxi, a sober friend, or a designated sober driver. Always plan for a safe ride home. The only decision that'll change your world for the better is the decision to call for a sober ride. It's never worth it to drive drunk. Don't risk it. Drive sober or get pulled over. Paid for by NHTSA.
I mentioned in the intro that, you know, a lot of people are discovering Formula One for the first time. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this have been following for fewer than 5 years, you know, and this tremendous growth that we've seen in the sport. But I've always felt that the sport itself hasn't really changed. You know, it's always been an amazing sport, full of intense, extreme people. It's always been visually fabulous, visceral, and all of these things, with always great storytelling.
Yeah.
And personalities and rivalries and all these things. It's just that it was kind of a sleeping giant. It needed Liberty Media to come in and sort of unlock it for a much bigger worldwide audience than it was being exposed to before. And so I think, you know, we've been fortunate in a way to sort of live through that period which wasn't so visible. But what did you enjoy about the sort of that period of the early days, you know, the sort of Senna, Prost, Schumacher era, you know, when you could, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have that many people back at home who knew what you were talking about when you were saying what a great character Senna was or whatever.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think about it when I returned to my home in Auckland in New Zealand, that my neighbours in, I don't know, you know, 7 or 8 years ago would see me back home and they'd be like, you know, got jet lag, where are you off to next? And that would be it. That would be the kind of the conversation. As soon as they start watching Drive to Survive, they're knocking on my door when they know I'm back and saying, oh, you know, why does science hate Vettel? And I'd be like, he doesn't. You know, it's ridiculous. But thank heavens for that series, really, because, as you say, it's changed the perception of the sport. But I guess, in a way, it's taken away. It's taken away time that we would get with drivers. It's taken away a kind of a slightly more simplistic nature of the sport. Where back in the day when I started, and as you know, you mentioned people like Prost and Senna, who were my teenage heroes. You know, Prost, when he was with Renault, was and as far as the way he drove, was my absolute idol. That then went into Senna when I was fortunate enough to start working, you know, around him, stroke with him. When I worked for an agency and we did the Rothmans work, I also worked at an agency when we did the Marlborough work. And of course, these were my heroes, which I had pictures on my wall, and all my weekends were spent following them as a teenager. And suddenly I'm in a garage, or I'm standing there asking Ayrton to pose for a picture, you know, and it was pinch yourself moments. But when I started as a photographer, you could walk into the team's hospitality, you could walk into the team's garages. There was no security as such. There were probably more photographers over a Grand Prix weekend as an average over the year. But it was just far simpler. There were circuits where we had two-tier Armco, you know, and you had monstrously fast cars, you know, that weren't rooted to the ground with the aero of now. And it was, I think at the time, obviously, one still, you know, I'm not really a guy who moans. I try and see the positive, especially in the job that I'm fortunate enough to do. But photographers would complain they couldn't do this, they couldn't do that. Well, come now and see the fences and the way we're corralled and the way we're treated like a herd of sheep in many ways. And I don't get down about that. But at the same time, as you correctly surmise, we have to be thankful that we were here for that, and then see where we are now. And on a kind of personal point, one of my first shoots that I did in with a Formula One celebrity, if you like, although he wasn't so much as a celebrity, he was a Leviathan of sport, was Ken Tyrrell. And I was dispatched by the boss of the agency I worked for to go to Ken's house and photograph Ken and Nora's 50th wedding anniversary portrait. And Ken, I did the picture, and I'm all kind of, again, you know, I'm like 20, 21, something like that, maybe a little bit earlier, a bit younger. And Ken sat me down at his bar, and kind of after we'd done the shoot, and said, right, lad, this is how you should approach your career. This is how you should do it. Have this attitude.
Really?
And, yeah, special moments, you know, almost get emotional about it. And Ken said, please, Darren, in all your career, for as long as you do it, be aware that it's not a great idea to look back with rose-tinted glasses on the past. We are naturally predisposed as human beings, I think, to do that. But he said, and there was a picture, interestingly enough, or Ryan, a picture of a car jumping over the Flugplatz on the ring. And he looked at it and he said, I bet you'd like to take that picture, lad, wouldn't you? And I said, of course. I said, yes, Mr. Ken, you're my sister to Daryl. And he said, now, when that picture was taken, be aware, in 1972 or whatever it was, be aware that the photographers and the people taking it would have said that it was much better in 1960.
Yeah.
It was much better in 1950. It was much better in 1930. He said, they've always said that. He said, but please, Darren, try to live in the moment and think to yourself that now is the best time. And that has stayed with me for my whole career. And as I say, I get emotional thinking about it, but that was a real lesson for me, and I still have that now. So I think we live in the best of times.
You know, it's one of the things you and I have got in common, is because that's always exactly been my attitude as well. I feel enormously blessed to have been around and to have known Senna, Prost, to have worked very closely with, particularly with Mansell and Schumacher, and got to know them very, very well. Those are really wonderful and rich experiences and rich memories. But Formula One itself is a sport that is always looking forward.
Yeah.
There's always the what next in Formula One.
We live on fast forward.
It's real life on fast forward, exactly that. But it's always what's the little thing I can get? Whatever job I'm doing, whether I'm an engineer, a driver, you know, what I do, what you do, what's my little competitive advantage that I can bring in next time round? And we're all kind of imbued with that same sort of mentality. I'll ask you, again, a question I'm sure you've answered 1,000 times, but it would be interesting for the listeners to hear it from you. Which period of cars, specifically, you're talking about the cars, the look of the cars, the way they are on the track, the visual appeal of them, which is your favourite?
I guess as a spectator, it would be back to the 80s, the early 80s. That was when I was really just so massively enthusiastic as a boy about Formula One. Moving into the period when I worked around them, I think those cars of those beautiful McLarens, the MP46, would be my favourite.
What period's that, then?
1991, sorry. 1991 car, Senna and Berger. Just beautifully simple. No ridiculous aerodynamic appendages all over them. Nice liveries, again, simple. Heroic drivers. You could see the drivers because we didn't have kind of built-up cockpit sides and survival cells. They're all good, and the halo device, and we all know the benefits of those. But as a photographer, I think visually and having a human element and seeing those drivers was wonderful. And then I guess moving on from those kind of 1991 kind of cars, it would be really the kind of 1999, 2000, 2001, maybe up to 2004. Again, beautiful liveries, simple cars, screaming V10 engines. Mm. As I've got older, I don't miss that noise as such, but still, it just brings something. People expect Formula One cars to be loud, and who's to say that's wrong? And driven by guys, you know, Häkkinen and Coulthard, Schumacher, but both Michael and Ralph, Alesi, Berger, latterly Raikkonen, Montoya. They just seem to me, of course, they're all kind of my age, you know, our age, but they just seemed a bit more heroic to me. And maybe some of that is because the cars were just so alive. They were smaller, they were more manoeuvrable, they moved around on the circuit. You were aware of that. Tremendous amount of power with not a tremendous amount of aero load. And it was just, I don't know, just a time that I think we slightly miss now.
And while we're talking about favourites, what about faces? Who to you are the drivers who have the most interesting faces?
Oh, wow, what a question. Most interesting faces. Well, the greatest profile in the history of sport is Lewis Hamilton's. It's instantly recognisable. And, of course, most of your listeners will be aware of the silhouette pictures that every photographer has taken with Lewis, with his various hair styles. But that's not a face as such. It's a difficult question, but I think if I had to go for one who just oozed charisma in the way that he looked, and of course the ability that he had, it would be Ayrton Senna. I know that maybe is an obvious thing to say, but there's never been a driver in my career that as soon as he walked into the garage, whether that was McLaren, I'm sure it was the same at Lotus, but I wasn't working Formula One then, or even Tolman. And certainly with Williams when he walked into that garage for only for sadly such a short period. But it was just like, okay, you know, he's arrived, Senna's arrived. Now we get serious. And it was also the way that he interjected with the engineers, what he knew he wanted on the car. I was fortunate to hear some radio talk, you know, and it was amazing to hear him. And I think facially, especially as he got a bit older, that really was something that a photographer could work with.
Well, speaking about getting older, one of the things I've noticed, if you look at a photograph of a Grand Prix driver when they make their debut, you know, they look so young and fresh faced.
They do, yeah.
I mean, you take someone like Jenson Button, for example. Senna's another good example.
Vettel.
There are so many examples. And that face ages 10 years in three.
Yes.
And
I
guess the strain, I don't know what it is, but you obviously see that looking through your viewfinder.
That's a good point, James. And you're the first journalist that has made that comment. Because I think photographers notice it, because we spend, you know, when I'm at a racetrack, I'm photographing the cars and the drivers. When I'm not at a racetrack, I'm spending 12, 14 hours a day editing my work. So you're just constantly staring at these guys. Now, when I go back and I do, say, some commercial client or editorial client says, right, we need a career profile of Sebastian Vettel, for instance. What he looked like when he was a BMW Friday driver? Honestly, he looks about 12 years old.
Mm.
At the time, it didn't strike me because he's just that Sebastian Vettel. By 2010, when he'd won a world title, when he won his first world title, he's like a man, and he's got stubble, and he's got a square jaw, and he's got some lines, and he's taken on this mantle. As you say, seems to have aged 10 years in three or four, and I think some of it. I think what we're going through now is when you look at Max Verstappen. He suddenly looks like a guy who is, I don't know, assumed that kind of emperor-like standing within the drivers. And, you know, look at Ollie Bearman now.
Mm.
The guy looks younger than my children. You know, younger
well,
than yours.
Younger than mine.
Yeah. But I bet you bottom dollar when hopefully Ollie, you know, keeps the career path and keeps the trajectory and gets into a really top team, that he'll suddenly become this kind of, you know, chiseled jawed, little bit of stubble, kind of heroic looking guy, rather than the little boy that we see now.
What about the standard of the driving today? I mean, I think you probably see out on the circuit perhaps more than any of us do. I mean, you know, a good commentator, a Martin Brundle, a Jolyon Palmer, you know, can look at on a TV screen and see driving standards. They can see what's good, what's bad, or whatever. But you see it, you know, close up on the side of the racetrack, and you see moments, and I'm sure you sense danger in a big way,
yeah.
You know, because you've seen plenty of accidents in your time. But how do you feel about the standard of these drivers at the moment?
I think it's pretty high. I don't think that they get the credit, really. If just a very recent example, the qualifying session in Vegas when it was wet. You know, it's a glass-like surface anyway, that circuit. When loads of water is dumped on it, everyone was expecting shunts galore. I never hoped for shunts. I'm not a crash chaser. I wasn't as a child. I was never encouraged to be as a photographer, and I don't like it, obviously. But you're aware that this could be a real issue. Well, what did we have? Did Alex Albon hit the wall in something of a...
You brushed know, it, yeah.
Brushed the wall, really, in that sense. And I don't think we had much else. Sometimes I miss stuff because I'm obviously photographing the cars. But I thought that was stunning. And yeah. I just don't think in these very wide, Leviathan-like size cars, ridiculously large and heavy, I believe, 5.2 metres long, aren't they? 2 metres wide, crazy heavy, just... 1,000 brake horsepower cars, to keep them out of the wall as they do is amazing. I'm not saying that they're any better than the drivers that we've been talking about, but I just don't think that they get quite the credit for it. And maybe the fact that so many of them are young, they get way less testing. Back in the day, you and me and a number of us would go to tests to do shoots with Michael Schumacher, people like that, and they'd be testing. Teams would have two or three teams. You don't have that now. How much testing do they get? 2 or 3 days before the start of the year, and each driver gets 1.5 of those days, and an end of season test after this race. That's basically it. I think the guys are amazing that they're not crashing more.
Well, you speak of crashes. I guess I do have to ask you the question. I mean, 36 years taking photographs of Formula One cars, and obviously safety's improved a lot over the years. But yeah, have you found yourself in a situation trackside where you thought I might be in trouble here and been witness to and been a bit too close to a major accident?
I've been fortunate that I haven't really. I've been in danger, I feel, myself. I guess there's an inherent danger because of where we can stand. It's safer now because of runoff areas and because of the debris fencing, which, as I said earlier, we didn't have. But I guess the one instance that I think about is Imola 94. I was photographing, not because I was in danger, but I was scared for the drivers. I was frightened for some of these guys who were, I wouldn't say friends, but they're acquaintances and people that I got to know. And that, the chicane that was just before the start-finish line, when Rubens had his shunt, and I, like a lot of us, Rubens is a lovely guy, I knew him quite well, you know, you couldn't not like Rubens. And seeing the cars come through that chicane, and the way the cars were moving, I was convinced there was going to be a shunt, hoping against hope that there wouldn't be, but convinced. And my Lord, there was a shunt. And of course, it was someone that I was closer to than perhaps I was the other drivers. And that was quite shocking to behold. But of course, all the time, you've got to keep shooting. And when he went into the wall and into the tyres and had that shunt, which we see in the Senna movie, that really gets across, that bang as he hits the wall. A light aircraft crash, basically. But then that shocking way that we all see the kind of flat bottom of the car and the marshals just come and push it over and it slaps down on the ground and Ruben's head rocks inside because there was no hands, there was no halo. There were low cockpit sides. And I just, oh my Lord, you know, that's just, you've got to really hope against hope that he's okay. Fortunately, he was. But other than that, obviously I've been at circuits where there have been shunts, Bianchi at Suzuka, but I didn't actually see them. I wasn't at those corners. So I've been fortunate in that way, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. What aspect of F1 that you see when you're standing trackside do you think doesn't come across across the media to the public, you know, you, with TV or written word? You know, I mean, you mentioned earlier on what you saw in Vegas and how impressed you were with the standard of the driving on what was clearly a slippery track and it started to rain. But what aspect of this sport do you think you see that perhaps is not really coming across to the public?
I think the speed. The unbelievable deceleration and particularly these days acceleration that the cars have with the electric power out of the corners, it's mind-blowing just how much traction they have away from the corners. But also it's the cornering levels, the way that aero is working, the speed of them. I think we do, in those sizzle pieces that you talked about, we do see some of that. But if you look back at the great onboard laps, Senna springs to mind at Monaco, obviously we've all seen that a million times, and we never tire of seeing that a million times. It's that the technology of the TV cameras has also almost got too good, and the high def and the pixel rates and everything is so wonderful that you don't get so much sense of that. Kind of craziness and grabbing at gears, and I think some of that has gone. The in helmet camera that the guys wear now, I think that's bought something.
Yeah.
But almost in a computer game way, it almost doesn't look real in a way. I don't envy the TV directors or producers, but I do think that there could be some work made to I don't know, bring about that kind of, as you said earlier, that visceral sense of speed and danger a bit more.
Well, they're always working on it. They're always trying. Yeah. I mean, in a way, they made the onboard cameras a bit too perfect.
Yes.
It looked like it easy. It looked like you or I could do it, or our granny could do it, compared to the onboards in the sort of Damon Hill or Santa era when they were first coming in. But
yeah.
you talk about you're talking finally on the spectacle. Let's throw it forward then, as we always do in Formula One, to next year. You know, we've both lived through quite a few major rule changes in this sport. Some of them improved it, some of them didn't improve the sport.
Yeah.
But 2026 is definitely going to be a big one. The cars will be quite different. What are you expecting?
I think, like a lot of people, I'm a little bit unsure about what to expect. I listen to people with more knowledge than me about what the cars are going to be like, for whether that's engineers or journalists or, you know, people who study the sport more. And I hear that the cars will be 1 second slower over lap, 6 seconds slower, whatever. I don't doubt that by about Silverstone, they'll almost be on parity, because the geniuses that design and build these cars and the talent that drives them will get those cars back to where they were. And I love that. I love that about the sport, and I know you do. And it's so much the brains trust in Formula One is just constantly wonderful to behold. But I'd like the cars to be considerably lighter. I'd like them to be smaller, just so that you get more of that movement, more of that kind of, you know, it's going to encourage, I think, more overtaking if you have cars that are smaller on circuits, because I don't think you can start adjusting circuits for the monstrous size of the cars. But the big change that I'd like to see, James, is that somehow the FIA change the regulations around weight, so that we can have cars that don't run all black carbon liveries. And I don't blame the teams. If the rules are there and it's an advantage to run them black, run them basically naked, just with a bit of papaya, a bit of red, a bit of, you know, purple, or whatever colours the commercial partners insist upon. But when you look back at the 2000s or previously, and you look at the start picture, It looks like someone's chucked a bag of M&Ms on the track. There's just colours everywhere, and it looks wonderful. And I think if you compare that now, it's a lot of dark shapes on the track, and yet we are attracting an ever younger crowd that lives in colour. We live in a world of colour, and I think it would be a real boon for the sport if we could bring something of that back.
And you've talked about staying relevant and what have you. We talked about the iconic photographers of the past and how they used things like zoom lenses when they first came in to really enhance the coverage of speed in photography and what have you. How do you stay relevant? I mean, you know, camera technology is moving apace. I'm sure I'm not an expert on that. And of course, we've pretty much all got a super high standard camera in our pockets in terms of our phones, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the iPhones now, I know a lot of professionals use iPhones for all kinds of shoots.
Absolutely.
Can't imagine you standing trackside and getting anything decent with an iPhone. But
covered,
what can you do with
I covered Goodwood one year on an iPhone.
No.
Which, yeah, absolutely. Which, you know, I suggested to McLaren at the time, and that was the first professional shoot I did on an iPhone. I guess staying relevant is incredibly important. There are some of the photographers we've talked about that kind of are inspirational to me in the photography that they did it in their peak of their powers, but also inspirational on the other side, in that they didn't, I don't think, move with the times, and they stayed doing what they were doing. That's not to be disingenuous, but I think if one wants to have a long career in a sport, and especially when you're trying to be relevant in the world of Instagram, in the world of people looking at your pictures for about 2.5 seconds, I think it's beholden on any artist to be aware of social influences, to be aware of the technology, as you say, and just as I said before, study what's happening within your world of photography, particular world you're in, and without. And try and bring those influences in, and you know, be aware of what went before, and how perhaps you can mold that to add something to your creative palette currently.
And for people who aren't photographers but are lucky enough to find themselves at a Grand Prix next season, you know, whether they're in the grandstands or they're a bit closer to the action or they find themselves in the event, a couple of little tips about how to use an iPhone or a camera phone to...
Well, first of all, follow me on Instagram. I guess try and think that when you go to a circuit, when you go to any sporting event, any event that you're photographing, really, but obviously we're talking about Formula One, try and present your weekend or your day or however the time period you're there as a story. So try and say in your mind, think, right, I need to come out of here with 10 pictures and I want some establishing shots. I want some views. I want some beautiful light studies. I want maybe some faces if you're fortunate enough to be in those kind of areas where you can get close to the drivers. Don't just think about cars, though. Turn around and look at your fellow fans. Flags, kids on their dad's shoulders, you know, groups of people having a good time. That there's pictures everywhere. There's pictures all around. And, you know, just kind of, you know, come away with a set of pictures that you can be proud of.
Darren, I could talk to you all day, but we've both got to get to the racetrack and do some work.
So
it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. And the fans should check out your Instagram at @artoff1, right?
Yep, that's right.
And I would also recommend looking out for Darren's books on photography. It's an ideal Christmas present. It's in the run-up to Christmas. So have a look online and just see this incredible work that Darren's done over the last 36 years. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllenOnF1 on X. And my thanks to producer Ben, and thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We love seeing new listeners discover the podcast, and we'll be back with another one very soon.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.